Easter should be the best day of the year. It's a celebration of the resurrection of hope. Come to Crossroads Church and celebrate an empty tomb and a living hope. Info and service times at crossroads.net.
Today on The Grave Talks, the ghosts of CLO Drive. Decades of murder, tragedy, and sorrow seem to follow the path of CLO Drive. History takes the dark stories all the way back to the time when Native Americans inhabited the land. As time would progress, many other souls would live their final days on CLO Drive, including Sharon Tate and the spot where she was murdered. In the late 1990s, David Omen and his father decided to call CLO Drive home and began building a house on this infamous road. He would soon discover that his new home may hold the spirits of a tragic past.
Literally the Native Americans made an incursion on the landholder that was literally was about a mile from my house where the Native Americans and this Mexicans basically had a battle. And three Native Americans were killed and left there in the Walnut Grove, only to be discovered and uncovered in 1925 when ground was broken for the Beverly Hills First Woman's Club. And this ties into the story where I was told by different people, you know, I want to say 100 years later, but let's say 1920. So about 80 years later, when we bought the lot, people, friends of mine, were coming up here saying, you know, they felt Native American presence. And I'm like, oh, yeah, shut the fuck. You know, I was so dismissive of it because I was like, sure, you're psychic and you're picking up Native Americans. They said, get off your gosh darn peyote buttons. And it turns out, literally a few years later, I found out that these Native Americans were actually here. And that's when I discovered and heard the story of the uncovering of the bones of the three Native Americans a mile from the house. And then uncovered the whole backstory of the 1842 battle. And then it was like, oh, shit. Then Lisa Williams trips into the house in 2006 and ends up telling me that there's a Native American she feels whose body is somewhere, her remains are somewhere in the side of the hill upon which this house is built.
Wow.
So it was like, wait a second. I said, Native. And that's when it was all came together after Lisa told me that I had this. You know, I found out this information from the Benedict Canyon Association from their monthly, their biannual newsletter. And it was like, oh, no, Lisa Williams was right. These people and friends of mine were absolutely correct about Native American energies here, that there were Native Americans here. So it was like history actually crossed paths with the paranormal.
Yeah. I mean, it's information that I suppose we could almost say that in about many, many areas of where Native Americans had once been. But when you have the battles and you have the tragedy and the heartbreak that happened on specific pieces of land, were you able to, or was she able to get that information and cross-reference it with any existing Native American tribes or organizations about the battle and about the bodies that may be there?
Well, the battle is separate from here. The battle just corroborated her story when she said in 2006 that she felt Native American, that there was one who has died. It was separate from the battle. He died by accident. Apparently, as according to her story, he was walking on what is now the driveway, which was a horse path to the end of the driveway, which is a plateau that looked out upon the downward part of the canyon. And what was interesting is every gosh darn psychic that had been around here said that they felt this land, this hillside, had very, very strong energy. And it was like, oh, great. And they said, where this Native American possibly was going to, it made sense why he was up here then. I was like, oh, great. But he happened to fall off of his horse, and the horse came down the hillside and broke both of their necks when they tumbled down the slope, and they stopped. And their bodies were left there for 200 years, so to speak. And through the course of time, they were covered by the mudslides and the the movement of the earth around here, and the remains were literally interred in the earth under this mountain that I live on.
So that's one of the initial documented tragedies of this area.
Yeah. And the Native Americans, again, that was something that was documented by the Mexican, the woman who owned the 4,500 acres, which included Benedict Canyon, all of Beverly Hills, all the way down to Culver City, all the way out to, like, I forgot exactly where, it was probably about 30 miles east of downtown LA, that she owned the whole swath of land. That her husband, who had died was a commissioned officer in the Mexican army, they deeded that land to her. Mm-hmm. And that included all of this hillside and all of the mountains here. And the canyon, Benedict Canyon, was all walnut groves that she had developed. And the Native Americans were forced up into the canyons, and they would come down and do raids. I guess they do, stash and grab raids of her ranch, which was over on Sunset and Alpine, about a little over a mile and a half away from where we are right now. And on this occasion in 1842, her ranch hands were basically sick and tired of having to deal with the theft of livestock and produce, so that they actually mounted an aggressive attack to put this to an end. And that was the last incursion that the Native Americans made on her adobe or her ranch. And they basically killed three of the Native Americans in that war tribe that came down there on the raid tribe, and were buried on the spot in the middle of the walnut orchard that literally 80 years later was where they started developing the land to build the Beverly Hills First Woman's Club in 1925.
So you have that as the starting point, the area where much development is going to be happening over the next 100, 200 years.
Right.
As things do progress then, and modern society starts to come into fruition, what begins to develop over this plot of land?
On that plot of land, well, where the walnut orchard was, and where the Beverly Hills First Woman's Club in 1925, it was the first built, one of the first, not homes, but municipal buildings that they put up that far north of the city itself. There were homes up here. I mean, Rudolph Valentino's home was being built at the time. Greystone Manor and Pickfair were being built. But it was pretty much a rural area where in 1925, it was just starting to be developed. So that's the whole thing. And I did find out the name of the tribe. The name of the tribe that was in Southern California in this area and covered a pretty good portion of it for about 10,000 years was the Tongva tribe, T-O-N-G-V-A. And I have done research on them, and unfortunately it's a sad state of affairs that it's one of many of the tribes, or the nations, as the Native Americans would call themselves, that were usurped and removed and displaced as a result. And what I found in my research about the Native Americans is that most every part of the United States that we occupy was occupied by some tribe or some nation of Native Americans. I mean, it's just the research I did just blew my mind. I didn't realize how prolific these people were. And it's like the story of the story of Columbus discovering anything. As I do more and more research, I start to realize he discovered shit. Mm-hmm. It's a total misnomer what he discovered. He took upon himself to lay claim to it, but it's like, it's a different story when you talk about who was the first person on the planet, the moon. Fine and dandy. There was no humans there ever. Mm-hmm. Here in the United States, there were humans everywhere. They occupied and ran the country in small little, bands and groups and nations. So the fact that what he found was nothing. He discovered another country where people were living that were ready and able to be enslaved, brutalized, tormented, theft, stolen from, etc. So that's why I found that the Native Americans that were here of this tribe were not and did not look like the Plains Indians, as Zach Bagans, elicits in the show Ghost Adventures, they weren't running around with headdresses made of eagle feathers and wearing leather clothes made out of buffalo, because buffalo was an indigenous species and to the Native Americans who were in the Midwest, in the plains. But in the West, they didn't have buffalo, so they weren't making teepees. The Native Americans here lived in huts made of branches and twigs and such. And their headdresses, which they did have, because we have photographs of them, were made out of wood logs, and they were carved, intricately carved, you know, headdresses out of a chunk of wood, a tree trunk. It was amazing. So they used what was indigenous and close proximity to them for their use. So it's a matter of they dressed in the clothes and what they could gather from what was abundant locally. There was deer and wolf and bears and mountain lions. So their clothes were made from the indigenous species of the animals locally, so to speak. It wasn't like they had dresses made out of leather, but it was made out of deer skin. Mm-hmm. And it was different. It opened my mind to understand how deeply ignorant we are about our surroundings and the history of our areas. And when people said things and I scoffed them, I turned around and thought to myself, boy, I'm a bigger idiot than I thought. I don't know anything about my own area past 100 years ago.
Well, a lot of it is what we're taught, and we're not taught that much in our education system, unless as adults we go and dig deeper and deeper and deeper into what reality was.
Right. It's true, and it opened my mind up. So it gave me a deeper sense of reverence for the Native American, whether or not he was here, according to Lisa Williams, or not. I wanted to be able to show reverence to him, because I thought that if he's here, oh boy, this is more sacred ground to him, because this is where he died and his remains are interred. So I've always shown a certain integrity and respect towards that individual or that spirit since I found out, you know, the story about the Native Americans and their displacement and their hardships that they went through when living up in this area long before I even existed.
Sure.
So to me, it was just an interesting story. When she told me this, I was like, okay. I said, now, if this is true, other psychics that come into this area of the house, the earthen wall room under the third level, if they pick it up, this should be interesting. So I'm going to keep it under my hat and keep quiet about it and let anybody that goes in there tell me without tipping my hand and telling them a story and keeping it in the public. I kept it under wraps so that every time a psychic would come in, like James Von Prague, who went in there with Larry King Live, or Marianne Winkowski, or there was also Jackie Barrett from America's Psychic Challenge. When each one of these people went in there, I didn't say a word. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they got in there, it was almost instantaneous. They all said at one point or another, saying, I feel the presence of a Native American. Now, what's interesting is they didn't say it in plural. They said a Native American singular. Mm-hmm. I didn't say a word to them of any sort. So whatever they're picking up, they're picking up on their own. And I'm like, okay, tell me more. And then they would say, he's in here. And in some cases, it was an uncomfortable sensation that would then, as we say, take over the conversation. And it, in James Von Prague's case, it was like, he said, I don't feel very comfortable in here. I want to get out of here. Let's get out of here. And just left right after about 25 seconds in that room, which is telling to me. I don't know what that means, but I definitely made note of these experiences that every time I brought somebody in there and they would come up with a response, and then the follow-up was, I'm okay, or no, I want to be out of this room. I really don't feel comfortable. Let's go.
And I want to dive into the house itself and the experiences that are going on there, have gone on there. And we'll get to that in just a bit. Before we dive into that portion of our conversation, though, let's talk a little bit more about just the area itself, the drive itself. Obviously, it is home to tragedy. Can you touch on some of the other tragedy that is very close in proximity to where this house is?
Well, yeah, across the canyon, of course, literally, I don't know the distance, but it's less than a couple hundred feet. Across the canyon from my house sits Falcon Lair. And a lot of people won't be familiar with this person or this individual's name, but historically, he was the box office celebrity of his era. And we're talking about 1920 to 1926 when he died. And I'm talking about Guillermo Valentino, famously known as Rudolph Valentino, the Latin lover. Okay, Bree, sorry about that. He played many, many, many roles in his time as an actor, and they were all during the silent film era. And he had such charisma and such charm. And that, again, was not speaking. So it's not through his voice and through his charisma of that. It was just his presence. He had this very, very profound presence on the screen. And Rudolph had thousands, tens of thousands of fans, hundreds of thousands of fans across the globe. He was the matinee idol of his time, I'm hearing. And Rudolph was just so beloved, and he was a passionate character. He had a love of horses and had a stockade of horses in his in his barn, literally down at the bottom of his property. He had the kennels there too. He loved and had a couple of German shepherds. And Rudy built this house across the canyon as his love nest for his wife. Unfortunately, she hated it. She hated it to the point where she would retreat to her house in Hancock Park and without him and say, look, you can stay in your sports chalet that you've built up on the mountain. I hate it. You wonder why she hated it? Because in 1925, or about that era, that time, cars didn't have the greatest power plants. So you're talking about underpowered vehicles that had to travel all the way up into the mountain, literally, and up this steep hill. And it wasn't exactly, how should we say, close to the happenings. And what she didn't like was the fact that it was so far removed from Hollywood, which it really wasn't. Present day, it's not. But back in the day, it was the sticks. If you can imagine, we're talking about an area that was pretty empty, meaning that there were tracts of land that were wide, wide open. And then you'd have a mansion in the distance. You'd have a few mansions built into the mountains areas here, but they were enclaves secluded away from most of the happenings. And she hated it because her friends got lost. Her friends didn't want to drive out. You got to remember, to drive from Hollywood to LA in 1925 probably took you about 25, maybe 30 minutes at least. And then when you had to trudge up into the sticks, it was just very off-putting to her. And she never, ever lived there. And Rudy basically died, I believe, more of a broken heart than he did his busted appendix. But basically, he died brokenhearted at the fact that he struggled and went to all this trouble to build this house up here for her. He built it with his idea of being it for her without getting her input. And when he died, it left a tragic scar on him. And I mean, not on him, but his memory. And the house to this day, what's left of it, which is the servants' quarters and the guest quarters and the garage, are still haunted, to the point where the rumor goes that the gardeners will be in the garage working. And right now, the servants' quarters are basically just all, you know, used for storage, which is right above the garage. You can hear footsteps walking above the garage in the servants' quarters, where there is literally box after box. So there's no room to walk around there ably. And there's nobody in there to begin with. But they report, the gardeners report hearing the sound of footsteps echoing through the garage as there's somebody walking around at 12 o'clock noon every day.
Like clockwork. That's
like clockwork, yeah. Like, it's like noon. It's like, I got to come back and visit the homestead.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that house also has another tragedy in the fact that Doris Duke, the heiress of Duke University's money, the Duke family, which bestowed its name Duke to the university was made its millions or billions from the tobacco industry because they were out in North Carolina and Virginia. Well, Doris lived in that house for a number of years, and she was killed by her butler in that house. So there's a lot of other tragedies that took place in that house besides Rudolph's. Jimi Hendrix lived there for about 6 months. We all know what happened to Jimmy. Then we go to my street and the end of the drive where I live, which has its own, well, let's go back up. There's also a very famous murder up the street from us that ties into the house down the street from my house. And that house is the Paul Byrne house. And Paul Byrne was a famous producer back in the 1900s, early 1920s. And he married a famous blonde bombshell named, oh God, what is her name? Not Carol Lombard. Let me see. Oh, not Katharine Hepburn. Let's see. I'm looking for Paul Byrne's wife. And Paul Byrne's wife was Jean Harlow. Now, Jean Harlow was the very first blonde bombshell. And Jean and Paul lived up the street, up Benedict Canyon, about a mile away from here, at a home at 9860 Easton Drive. Well, I forgot the actual year, let me just tell you. In 1932, Paul was killed or found dead in his house that he lived in only for 3 months when he was married to this blonde bombshell, Jean Harlow. There was a funny, strange note that they left or they found next to Paul's body that was cryptic in way, but it didn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people. And the funny thing is that Jean called up the studio and the studio came out. The police did not arrive for a number of hours. I think it was 3 or 4 hours after the murder was uncovered. And in that time, there's a lot of conspiracy theories about what took place and who killed Paul Byrne and why it was that his naked body was found in the bedroom, in his bedroom, in the bathroom, on the floor, with a gunshot wound to his head. Wow. And what's strange is that 40 years later, Jay Sebring, 64, he ended up renting that house out. And Jay lived there, and Jay knew the history and loved the fact that the history had such a rich history with Paul Byrne. But there were strange things that were happening there. And I think it was in 1966, he was involved with Sharon Tate, the famous film actress who, we know, we'll get into what happened to Sharon and to Jay in a few minutes. But they were dating. And they were actually engaged. And there was a night that Sharon was home in the house and Jay was working late on the studio because Jay was a hairstylist for the stars. And Sharon remembers and told the story to a magazine back in the day. She said she woke up to see the naked apparition of a man, short man, about 5'3", 5'4", going through the desk in the bedroom and rifling through. He turned and he looked at Sharon. Sharon like freaked. He then dismissed Sharon being there and went back to looking through his table there. He was looking through the desk, looking for something. Sharon says she got up out of bed, walked out the room, went to the top of the stairs, and at the top of the stairs, she looked down at the bottom of this landing and says she saw the apparition of a blonde-haired woman in a nightgown tied to the rail post at the bottom with her neck slit from ear to ear, bleeding profusely. As the story goes, and I'm not making this up, this is factual, she walked down the staircase past the apparition of the woman tied to the rail, the banister at the bottom, went into the gosh darn bar and made herself a drink. She then started picking away at the wallpaper in a nervous fidge, I'd say. She's having a little bit of a nervous incident moment, so she started picking away at the wallpaper. She then finished her drink and went back upstairs. I don't remember if she says she saw the apparition there when she went back upstairs, but she went back upstairs and went to sleep. The following morning, Jake wakes her up and says, "Hun, what the hell happened?" She says, "What do you mean?" She went downstairs with Jay back to the bar where he took her and pointed out the spot on the wall where the wallpaper had been picked off. And she said, "Oh my God, it mustn't have been a dream then. I thought it was all a dream."
Oh God.
So some people attribute the experience of what she saw to a pretending or a foreshadowing or of a premonition of her impending death in 3 years. I don't know about that. If in fact she saw what she saw and how she saw it, it doesn't exactly corroborate, because Sharon wasn't ever having her throat slit from ear to ear. Mm-hmm. She was stabbed multiple times. Again, the fact that the image was of a blonde-haired woman the way she was, it could be that she was in fact seeing an apparition of her impending doom. I don't know. It's just too strange, a coincidence in so many ways. And then, of course, you know, up the street from my house, or down the driveway from my house, is where the infamous Sharon Tate murders took place on August 8th into the 9th, 1969, 50 years ago now. And that was a horrible, horrible, sad tragedy that honestly, what few people don't know is it could have been a lot, lot worse. And what I mean by that is people don't know that the marching orders originally for the three girls and Tex Watson were to kill everybody on the driveways, not only the people at the Sharon Tate house, but the people at the house next door to the Sharon Tate house, and then the people 50 feet away from that house, and then the people at the bottom of the driveway. All three of those homes were supposed to have the same diabolical, heinous acts of depravity and murder take place to them as well. But they didn't, because the girls were too tired after they first had their, after the murders took place.
Mm-hmm. With such a dark history here on this condensed area, do you feel that the land's indigenous history that we initially talked about has anything to do with the high level of tragedy in the area? Is there something there that's influencing things, causing things? I don't even know what the right word would be for it. And I'm not diving down the road of, people are becoming possessed and doing these things.
No, I know what you're saying.
But is there something?
I don't believe there's a direct connect. I think personally, if we did a historical review of Los Angeles in general, mm-hmm. or just any city in general, because I personally don't find the connection that the Native Americans have cursed it in some way, that I think man is cursed by man, mm-hmm. meaning humanity is humanity. We are a species of animal that has multiple facets to its personality. And the fact that people get murdered and people die, people get murdered and people die everywhere. Whether they be famous or non-famous, that, needless to say, means absolutely nothing. All that means is there's more notoriety, it's kept in the public persona, and somehow it leaves a greater stain than other murders. Where in fact, it's quite the opposite. It doesn't make a difference. Your soul is your soul. Your profession, be it your profession, fame or not famous, makes no difference. We're all going to die at some point, and human beings have been killing one another for thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. So I don't and won't go say that because the Native Americans were here that it's cursed, mm-hmm. and there's a connection to the tragedy. I know a lot of people like to decry that and then put that to the. I personally don't find that at all. I think that man is a messed up creature, mm-hmm. period.
Sure.
And the fact that these people died here, yeah, people die all over the place, famous and non-famous people. You know, I don't really see it as that. I just see it as, you know, people are a messed up thing.
Yeah.
And that's basically it. That's this happened here. There are tons of other murders that took place in other parts of the city that are not as well publicized, but are certainly still as tragic as this. And I think that that's just, you know, I think there was a book from 1972 called Hollywood Babylon. And then there was a book followed up called Hollywood Babylon 2, which delves into the murders and the tragedies of famous people in this city going back. And I mean, you can go back to the girl that threw herself off the Hollywood sign in 1920, I think it was, where she committed suicide. It happens all over the place. You've got the Black Dahlia in downtown LA. I don't think that there's a connection to one another. I think it's just that this area had people living. And, you know, here's another thing I just thought about. Think about this. When this place wasn't all developed in the 1920s and the mafia was still around, there are places up here where I have a feeling where people dump bodies in the canyons that we don't even know about, and that where people were murdered, you know, because there wasn't a lot of population up here. So you could get basically drive up 20 minutes, 30 minutes out of downtown LA, and wham, you're in the middle of nowhere back in those days.
Sure.
So what, you know, that's what I'm trying to say to you is, no, I think that that's just man. Man does that. And that's mankind's curse itself, is that I don't want to lay this upon the Native Americans and say they cursed it. I just think that, unfortunately, unhappiness and wealth go together.
Sure.
And I think there's your connection where you want to find it. Where there's wealth, there's always greed and unhappiness tied into it.
Yeah, I would agree. Where you have extreme ups and extreme downs, the more you have that, the more likely you're to see it. I think also sometimes, as far as history goes, a lot of times we tend to go back to the Native American time period and stop there and say, well, there was tragedy, so that must mean all the tragedy that came after it has to do with that. There was much history even prior to them. It's just we don't have it so well documented. I find sometimes that tragedy begets tragedy, and sadness and negativity begets sadness and negativity. And sometimes when you have something tragic happen in an area, a short time later, or even a significant time later, another thing happens. It's not necessarily that the two have anything to do with one another, but there may be some sort of energy there that doesn't really necessarily have a starting point with one specific person or group. It's just, it's still lurking. It's still there, but there's no one to blame from the previous tragedy for the next tragedy. It's just kind of lingering in the area. And all we can do is go back as far as things are documented and say, hey, this is the starting point, when really, no, that's the start of our bookkeeping. That's not truly the starting point of anything.
And I think there's something else to be said. I mean, we have a kind of a strange mythology about the Native Americans. Look, the Native Americans had slaves as well as, forget what we know about our the white settlers and their slaves. Native Americans traded in slaves as well. And I'm not talking about black African-American slaves. They traded in slaves of other tribes. Mm-hmm. When they made raids, when the Apaches made a raid on perhaps the Navajo or the Cherokee, they took slaves back with them and enslaved other people from other tribes to do their laborious work. That's something that that we don't really understand, that this is part, again, going back to mankind, that when the Native Americans then had to deal with the Spaniards, and then the Spaniards decided to proselytize them and convert them into good Christians, that was a form of enslavement. So this idea that the tragedy of the Native Americans started when the Spaniards enslaved them is not exactly true. Native tribes used to war on other Native tribes all the time, specifically to do raids, to get slaves and also get property and to take things away from them, to push them out of their area. So this is what we don't really think about. So the Native Americans here, the Tongva, from what I understand, they weren't a warring type of a tribe. They were more agrarian. So they were, you know, as you say, farming and stuff out here. And there were other tribes around them, like the Oh, let me see who there was. Up on the coastline, there was the, not the Iroquois, stupid. What? Oh, God, I got to remember the name of the different tribes. The Hopi were out further east. Unfortunately, I can't remember the name of the tribe that was on the ocean, on the coast here, that interacted with the Tongva tribe, and they traded and stuff. But they weren't warring factional tribes. Mm-hmm. So the point is, like I said, the tragedies that took place here, you got to remember, as I keep going back to, where you have a greater type of predisposition or a greater sense of wealth, that attracts a certain type of person. Sure. And with that type of personality comes other types of personalities that are basically, for lack of a better word, I want to say this, parasitically existing off of them. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've noticed. I mean, we have Greystone Manor, the Doheny Estate, which is just about 2 miles from here. There was a terrible, terrible, many, many murders and suicides that took place on that property. I don't think that the spirits that are there of those people are coming back to say, look, we want more people to be dead. Mm-hmm. That's something else people said to me. Do you think that those unhappy souls are coming back to want? I said, what, are they recruiting more people to die? No, this is not how I feel that it works. I think that, you know, again, man creates mythology to deal with what they don't understand. Sure. And in some cases, it's fear-based to control, fear-based to teach, but it's a lot of fear-based mongering, I call it, because you don't know what a spirit is, but from what I've seen and experienced here in 17 years, which is in my book that I wrote, is that spirits aren't trying to hurt anybody. And anyone that pushes that agenda is so off their mark, they need to be put down on a pedestal and taught lessons of life and understanding and compassion, because they are operating from a completely fear-based position. You want to know why you can't lie if you're a ghost? Because you got no skin in the game.
That wraps up part one of our interview with David Omen about the ghosts of Cielo Drive. He has a book of the same title available now wherever books are sold. In part two of our interview, we'll continue our discussion with David and ask him what made him and his father decide to build on this plot of land. According to David, what are the three possible responses one can have when dealing with something they don't understand? What were some of the first experiences David had in the house while it was under construction? And what kind of evidence has David captured in the home? And how has David made peace with the idea of living with ghosts? We'll discuss all of that and more in part two of our interview. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.